Ms. Coronado, would you take the roll, please?
Councilmember Eugene Connors?
Here.
Councilmember Joan Hanson is excused. Councilmember Shirley Dowdy?
Present.
Mayor Ron Ertley?
Present.
Mayor Pro Tem Anna Klein?
Here.
Councilmember Douglas Dunn?
Here.
Councilmember Serena Sullivan?
Here.
City staff, Justin Johnson, city manager, Ashley Coronado, city clerk, Sharon Bono, finance director, Cindy Moss, personnel director, Ben Reyna, police chief, Tom Climate, public works director, and Carl, city attorney.
Thank you very much for the invocation. We're honored tonight to have Ms. Terry Nudy.
If you pray, please pray with me, and if you don't, please honor a moment of silence. Father God, we just thank you for this day. I thank you for this council and the mayor. I pray, Father God, that you will give them clear heads and that they can work toward one purpose of having a good working government here in Bisbee. I thank you, Father God, for the good things that are happening, and I just ask you to just give us good minds so that we can see creative solutions to the big problems that we have here. And I ask that in Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you, Ms. Terry Nudy. Let's stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I have one announcement, somewhat lengthy, but I think it's important. Last week at a mayor manager's luncheon in Douglas, I made a presentation directed at Senator McCain and Flake's aides concerning cuts in the CDBG community development block grants that have occurred over the last 4 or 5 years. The presentation was forceful but polite, intended to elicit their attention, which it did. City Hall was contacted Monday morning by Senator McCain's office, which I anticipated they would. And today, the city manager, myself, met with Senator McCain's aide, Shay Salcedo, concerning this issue. CDBG grant funding has been reduced from about $4.5 billion to around $3 billion on a federal level. And to see what CDBG funding has done for Bisbee, you can look at the streets in Saginaw and Bakerville, primarily done by CDBG funding. We, as a city, have been reduced from about $350,000 over 2 years to about $200,000 every 3 years, with no doubt further cuts coming. My suggestion to Ms. Salcedo is to transfer about $500 million from the Department of Homeland Security budget, which is around $40 billion, to CDBG funding. With so many bridges, streets, roads, and other infrastructural deterioration across America, it is imperative that we act as a nation to prevent serious injuries and lives from infrastructural decline. The meeting with Ms. Salcedo was polite, and she assured me Senator McCain would get this information. Homeland Security should be also about saving lives and injury from a damaged infrastructure. Thank you. We're not going to go call to the public. We have a few people signed up. We'll start off with Harry Pace.
My name is Harry. I live at 308 Douglas Street. I'm also on the committee for streets and infrastructure. I was loaned a book about the streets and the walls over in Old Bisbee. They're really bad. They're cracking and falling down. And that's one thing we need to concern ourselves with, besides fixing the potholes in the streets. And I just want to make a speech about that, and if we can get the funds in, a little less, it'll probably take about 10 or 12 years to fix most of the streets. I saw some of the red areas, and it's really bad. You can probably break the axle if you hit a pothole and go with the fast. And I was thinking, I was just talking to the mayor, if we can get some kind of club, like a 4-H club, for the kids to learn something about agriculture and farming, that would keep them out of trouble. And I'll even volunteer 15 to 20 hours a week in doing so. Teach them something about that. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thank you. Next call to the public, we have Donna Pulling.
Thank you, Mayor. Donna Pulling. I live in Bisbee, and although there are several items on the agenda this evening that I would like to talk about, I am here to announce the community garden. The Bisbee Community Garden is on its way. It's up and running for construction this weekend. We've been in the formative stages. Council Member Sullivan, Serena Sullivan, has been very instrumental in getting this project moving with permission and licenses and leases and all of that. The garden is located in Warren on 4th Street, right across from the Washington Federal Building. Up that street, at the end of that street, there's about a half an acre of land that will be graded this weekend, beginning Friday. Gil Niederlitzer is offering his heavy equipment grading machine. We will look for volunteers beginning at 10 a.m. on Friday until 3. Same thing on Saturday, same thing on Sunday, same thing on Monday. Freeport is contributing top soil to this program. And so we're looking for hands on deck, gloves, hats, water, and come ready to work in the community garden. It's finally coming to fruition. So thank you.
Thank you. Item number one, accounts payable. Do we have a motion?
I move that we pay accounts payable in the amount of $263,986.04.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? No discussion. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. Item number two, approval of the consent agenda, items A through H. I will read them. A, approval of the appointment of Stephen Day to the Streets and Infrastructure Committee with a residency requirement waiver. B, approval of the appointment of Joe Mousy to the Streets and Infrastructure Committee with a residency requirement waiver. C, approval of the appointment of William Bonacker to the Design Review Board. D, approval of the appointment of Bliss Springs to the Transit Advisory Committee. E, approval of a park facility and right-of-way use permit for the Bisbee Coffee Company, LLC, for the use of downtown Lowell for an Americana Music Festival and car show on Saturday, March the 21st, 2015, from 12 p.m. to 12 a.m., and for setup and takedown between March 20th through March 22nd, 2015. F, approval of a special event liquor license application submitted by the Bisbee Vogue, Incorporated, for an event to be held in downtown Lowell, Bisbee, on Saturday, March the 21st, 2015, from 11 a.m. till 11 p.m. G, approval of a liquor license application for the Giant Store, number 668, located at 94 Bisbee Road, Bisbee, Arizona, Roger Burton, applicant. H, approval of a liquor license application for the Giant Store, number 658, located at 504 Highway 92, Bisbee, Arizona, Roger Burton, applicant. Do we have a motion?
I move that we approve the consent agenda items A through H.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to approve the consent agenda items A through H. Ms. Coronado, would you take the roll, please?
Councilmember Connors?
Aye.
Councilmember Dowdy?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Klein?
Aye.
Councilmember Dunn?
Aye.
Councilmember Sullivan?
Aye.
Mayor Ertler?
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Item number three. Public auction of designated surplus property located adjacent to 5B Moon Canyon, Parcel B, as indicated on the attached map. And this is the time and place set for the public auction of the designated surplus property located on a portion of unnamed public right-of-way that parallels the southeast side of 5B Moon Canyon or Parcel B, as indicated on the map, and that the minimum bid is $2,571. Do we have a bid?
I have a question.
Yes.
I'd like some clarification in terms of this request. First of all, does Mr. Sadler now own any part of that building?
Councilmember Dunn, Mayor, other council members, my name is Christopher Hitchcock. I'm here representing Ms. Sandler and Mr. Sandler and Ms. Hagstrom. they assert a personal property interest right in that building, having bought that from the previous owner of the property, and have having used it over the 32 years, I think, that they've lived in that residence adjacent to that property. The city attorney and I have exchanged views over the nuances of fixture law in the state of Arizona, and we have agreed to disagree. She believes that the property runs with the land, and I believe it does not run with the land. And that means the property would pass, she has taken the position that the property would pass with the underlying real estate, and I am taking the position that it is separate, a separate property interest. So we have agreed to disagree, and I'm here primarily to basically preserve my client's position.
The map is not clear in terms of the line. It comes across the, I'm not sure which the back corner of the building, and that's my question has anyone determined whether that
it's
is?
My understanding is that the garage / studio is on that parcel of land.
It is my understanding that there is support of some kind for it that may run in onto the other property that's adjoining it, but or that abuts the property, but that it is on city property, that it is a fixture on city property. We're not talking about a trailer. We're talking about a garage. And, you know, that is personal to you.
Okay.
I'm sorry. A trailer would be personal to you. Excuse me. A trailer would be personal to you. The garage is affixed.
I just want to make sure if another party purchases this that indeed they are getting the full building.
It is our position they would not.
Okay.
It is my position that the city would be quick claim deeding this property like it does with all property. So it would be providing any interest that it has in the property, and that is all.
Okay. Also, my question is there room for parking? We're certainly off of a street that actually, on-street parking is really not an option there, it seems to me, and that curve and that slope of Adams Street. Is there adequate room to serve by parking for this structure?
Mr. Ward is not here today to answer that, but he's been up there and tells me that there is room for one vehicle. Maybe, but that is not something that I have firsthand knowledge of.
Another question, that is that if a non-neighboring party purchases this property, would it be considered a lot parcel split?
Right, and
that's beyond well, that would have to be decided by a court, more than likely.
Well, my view on that is that the lot split issue that you're talking about is an issue with our zoning code. And cities, I think the case is Scottsdale v. Tempe. Cities don't have to follow their own zoning codes. But my view of the lot split issue is that if we did have to follow it, that because this property is alongside a right-of-way, we're not splitting a parcel or lot in that same way that I think that the lot split regulation in the zoning code was written. But we don't have to follow, as a municipality, we don't have to follow our own zoning code.
I'm just wanting to make sure that everyone is aware of what the situation is. And I think there are certain ramifications to the city depending on how this vote or this auction goes. And I'm raising those questions.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. And I have questions.
Council Member Connors.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm looking at the map. And so, you know, do as I say but not as I do.
Right.
Okay? That's the city's point. We don't have to follow. Should we maintain that property? If I'm reading this right, it's 20 and a half feet at the widest end, and 133.49 feet on the south end of that piece of property?
I'm afraid I can't confirm that.
Okay, well, let's just say it is because I'm looking at it and I'm reading it.
Right.
Okay, and let's say that this property didn't go to the Sandlers. And this is just hypothetical, and I know lawyers and a lot of people don't like to do hypotheticals, but you're going to have to indulge me, whomever's going to answer this question. If it didn't go to the Hagstroms, would that building then become, would it have to follow all the setback, 5 feet and 10 feet setbacks? Would we, you know, would we then behave like we're supposed to behave and not in enforcing zoning and setback laws?
You know, we were put into this position not of our own volition, right? And so the city's trying to make lemonade out of lemons, right? So in terms of your question about setbacks, et cetera, again, the city doesn't have to follow its own zoning code. So that doesn't really apply. But it also doesn't apply. I don't think it applies in that that building is there now. And it has been there for a long time. The Sandlers, I believe, have owned their property for 32 years, and it was put on that property prior to their purchasing the property.
My understanding is it's shortly after World War II, so it's been there for some time, and certainly I think there's a good argument that it's grandfathered into the zoning laws and any setbacks, as a lot of old Bisbee properties have been built prior to the enactment of the zoning law. So take that for what it's worth, a free opinion.
At this time, we are going to take bids on this piece of property. That's what we're going to do. There's a lot of issues surrounding this, but I think that needs to be settled later. The city has on the agenda to sell this piece of land. Do we have a bid?
Mr. Mayor,
excuse me, the minimum bid is
$2,571. On behalf of Ms. Hagstrom and Mr. Sandler, I bid $2,571.
Do we have another bid? State your name, too.
My name is Tanya Borgeson, and my bid is $5,000.
We now have a bid of $5,000 from Ms. Borgeson. Mr. Hitchcock.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. On behalf of Ms. Hagstrom and Mr. Sandler, my bid is now $6,000.
We now have a bid of $6,000 from Mr. Hitchcock representing Ms. Hagstrom and Mr. Sandler.
This is Tanya Borgeson. My bid is now $6,500.
We now have a bid of $6,500 from Ms. Borgeson.
On behalf of my clients, our bid is now $7,500.
We now have a bid from Mr. Hitchcock representing Ms. Hagstrom and Mr. Sandler of $7,500.
This is Tanya Borgeson, and my bid is $7,800.
We now have a bid from Ms. Borgeson of $7,800.
On behalf of my clients, the bid is now $8,000.
The bid is now $8,000 for Mr. Hitchcock representing his clients.
This is Tanya Borgeson. My bid is now $8,200.
We now have a bid from Ms. Borgeson of $8,200.
On behalf of my clients, the bid is now $9,000.
We now have a bid of $9,000 from Mr. Hitchcock representing his clients.
This is Tanya Borgeson. My bid is now $9,200.
We now have a bid from Ms. Borgeson of $9,200.
On behalf of my clients, their bid is now $10,000.
We now have a bid from Mr. Hitchcock representing his clients of $10,000.
This is Tanya Borgeson. My bid is now $10,200.
We now have a bid from Ms. Borgeson of $10,200.
I have no further bids.
Are there any other bids? Going once, going twice. Sold to Ms. Tanya Borgeson for $10,200.
Thank you, Council.
We now have to, as a council, move to accept the most favorable bid that meets the minimum bid requirements. Do we have a motion on that? I'll make a motion that we accept the bid of $10,200 from Tanya Borgeson for this piece of property. Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
We have a motion and second. This item, Ms. Coronado, I need a roll call vote.
Councilmember Connors?
Aye.
Councilmember Dowdy?
Nay.
Mayor Pro Tem Klein?
Nay.
Councilmember Dunn?
Aye.
Councilmember Sullivan?
Aye.
Mayor Eartley?
Aye. Motion passes, I believe, 4-2-2. Thank you. Item number 5. Presentation by the Public Safety Personnel Retirement System Task Force. Let me refer over to the City Manager, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mayor, members of the Council.
I'm sorry, but that should be item number
4. Oh, excuse me. Pardon me, I skipped an agenda item. Item number 4. Discussion of possible direction to staff on a petition received by Susan Blackford regarding twice-a-week pickup in the Warren and San Jose areas during the months of May through September. I'm going to read the pertinent parts of this particular petition. The petition states that I am asking the mayor and city council to take seriously my attached position to resume garbage pickup to Warren and San Jose area to twice a week during May through the end of September of each year, just 5 months. Old Bisbee still has twice a week service. According to Arizona state law, city can pick up trash just once a week as long as it does not go over that limit. The city is in compliance with state law, but according to the citizens of these areas, we have health and environmental concerns in Warren and San Jose areas during the hot and raining months. It is like Lord of the Flies in neighborhoods, with trash bins overflowing, flies, mice, and mosquitoes, and more all over that area, as well as spreading through the neighborhood. Any person who says they have never seen the increase of these insects over the last several years has never taken out their own trash. To its citizens, we consider it a health and environmental issue. Talking to Cochise Health Department, there are no documentation done to support this fact. Reasons, cities all over the country pick up the trash several times a week. No need for studies. Studies are being done in third world countries, which Bisbee looks like in the summer months. According to Orkin Pest Control, house flies are major carriers of disease. They are known to transfer over 100 pathogens, resulting in ailments including typhoid, tuberculosis, cholera, and dysentery. House flies collect these pathogens on their legs and mouth when feeding on feces, trash, and other decaying material. We do have one person signed up, Susan Blackford.
Good evening, Mayor, Council, guests. Thank you very much for reading my petition.
Ms. Blackford, would you like to pull those microphones maybe just down a little bit?
Yes, please.
There you go.
Do you want me to start over?
What's that?
Start over thanking
okay.
you all. Okay, thank you all. Okay. I am sure I'm not the first one complaining about the trash in hot summer months. I'm sure maybe you all have seen it and maybe have heard from your constituents in the past. In my opinion, the last mayor proposed ideas that divided this town. We have a new mayor and council who believe in actions towards uniting this town. This petition will do that, showing that this council is concerned with the city's citizens of all areas. In my opinion, a lot of money was wasted in the last 2 years. Let's find the money to make this work. On this subject, I have one more idea. Maybe the mayor and council could sponsor a spring and fall cleanup day for the whole town. Once that is worked out, they may even send out a flyer promoting our recycling on one side and the trash pickup day on the other. If anybody is interested on the council, I would be glad to work with anyone with this idea. Thank you very much for taking up my petition.
Thank you. Now, any comments from the council? Without objection, Councilmember Dowdy.
Do we have the manpower and, you know, that could do this twice a week?
Yeah, I had the same concern. I was simply, Councilmember Dowdy, I was simply going to direct staff to look into the logics and the cost of this particular issue, and I'm sure they don't know exactly what that cost or the logistics of that would be. So without objection from the council, I will direct staff to look into this particular petition.
Okay.
Now we'll go to item number five. Presentation by Public Safety Personnel Retirement System Task Force, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mayor, members of the council. I'm very pleased to introduce Mr. Scott McCarty, as well as Ms. Barbara Fleming with the City of Sierra Vista Human Resources Department. On yesterday, we had an opportunity to go up to the town of Oro Valley and receive some training by way of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. And obviously, the issues surrounding the public safety retirement system is quite a detriment to a point for the city of Bisbee. And so a task force was created through the League of Arizona Cities and Towns, made up of members of finance directors, town managers, and the like, to try to help cities come up with solutions. The chair of that committee is Mr. McCarty, who's here to give us a presentation. Many of you were in attendance, but also I just felt like it was a great opportunity for members of the council that didn't get a chance to go, as well as members of the public and members of the media, to kind of hear our situation and hear about, you know, maybe solutions, alternatives, ideas. This is information for us, very useful information, and I really hope that we all kind of open up here and try to pick up as much as we can. And with that said, I'll turn it over to Scott. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mayor, members of the Town Council, for having the task force being given the opportunity to come speak to you all tonight. As Mr. Johnson said, I'm chair of the League of Cities and Towns task force that's been put together to take a look at the situation within the public safety retirement system, the acronym for which is PSPRS. On the screen in front of you, we've got several slides we'll be walking you through, and when we do that, we're really, really trying to accomplish two things tonight. The first is to share our perspective on this issue and what the task force has been up to. And again, the task force was put together by the Executive Committee of the League of Cities and Towns. And then the second thing really is to talk a little bit about your situation here and get some feedback from you that we can take back to our task force discussions as we move forward with putting together final recommendations throughout the rest of 2015. So it's very important that we're here listening to you and what you have to say to us, and I want to assure you that that'll make its way back to the Phoenix metro area when we have our next meeting in the early part of March. So a little bit of logistic background about the task force. We were formed again at the pleasure of the League's Executive Committee back in June of 2014. In partnership with the Arizona City Managers Association and the Government Financiers Office Association in terms of the collaboration they had with the League of Cities and Towns. There's 15 members on this task force. They all have varying professional backgrounds. Some people are managers, whether they're city managers or county managers. They might be finance directors in the city or a county, HR backgrounds, intergovernmental liaison backgrounds, and economists. So we've got a very well-defined membership. They come from small cities, big cities, small counties, and big counties. So we've got a good diversity that's intended to honestly reflect the demographics of the plans that are in the PSPRS system. And our charge was really to review all aspects of PSPRS, identify areas of improvement, and identify reform recommendations for the current system. In terms of an overview of PSPRS, and I know you all have had at least one conversation about your specifics, but from the whole system's perspective, it's made up of 256 different employers that have individual plans. So, for example, like you have here in Bisbee, you have a plan for police and a plan for fire, and they are, from a financial perspective, completely distinct, have different rates, have different contributions, and have a different financial status. That is true across the state. Some counties have two plans. Some counties might just have one. Some cities have two plans. Some cities might just have one. But altogether, there's 256 different plans in the system. And that makes up about 32,000 retirees and active members in terms of across the entire state. The benefit structure for all the recipients is the same. In other words, it's the same for all plans. But what does vary, as I alluded to earlier, is the financial condition of the plans. In the aggregate, all the plans are $6.6 billion underfunded. We'll talk a little bit about what that means as I go through some of the slides. As you well know, the employer contribution rates and the contribution amounts vary by plan, but the employee contribution rates are the same. And effective July 1st, 2015, the employee rates will be 11.65%. So a little bit of background about the plan. Let's talk a little bit about how the task force is approaching our work that we began back in July. We really broke it down into three phases. The first phase is really just information and education, and I'll take you through what we've learned through that process. The second phase is what we've just released lately, which is our employer recommended practices. Those are tangible things that plan members can do now to help affect and improve their financial condition. And then the third phase is what I alluded to earlier. This is really developing a yardstick for what the good characteristics of a successful and well-designed plan need to look like. And we expect that to play out over the course of 2015. So at the phase one level, we had, as the task force, we had 14 different presentations from all kinds of organizations across the entire country. These are people who've been involved in pension reform in other states. Really, they're subject matter experts, whether it's financial or legal or actuarial, and they came to us and shared their thoughts and views about what's going on across the rest of the country and how that may or may not be relevant here in Arizona. And sometimes we learned as much from cases where in other parts of the country where things didn't work as we did about what did work. So that was very important.
Can you give me an example of somewhere where it does work?
In terms of pensions?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the best examples is that there is no system like our system in any other part of the country. So there's no system where you have those different 256 different plans. Does that help?
Well, it doesn't help at all. But what it does communicate is an inability to come together as a state and agree on how to manage a pension fund.
Okay. Let me, having thought about your question, let me give a more direct answer. In a lot of other states, there's a proportionate share of what the employee pays and what the employer pays. So let's say it's one-third, two-thirds. The employee will pay one-third of the total cost, and the employer might pay two-thirds of the cost. Our system, as I alluded to earlier, is fixed at the employee level, which means the employer picks up that entire difference. So that's one of the things in some of the more successful plans that are out there. When rates move, both sides, if you will, move relative to that rate increase, and it's not completely borne by the employer, which is the case in our plan.
Do you see any potential movement from the state legislature's level? I mean, we can pray and hope, but what's the reality of something changing up, in the state house?
Well, I think if you'll allow me the chance to get through some slides, we talk about that.
I'll do that, and I'll try to write your questions down. However, I'm going to reserve the right to stop you in the future because of the stuff you talk right over my head, right past me, and therefore, I need to slow down. I need for you to slow down, and that doesn't mean I need to make this painful for everyone.
Sure.
But I'm trying, as best I can to understand why and why not anything, you know, why is something isn't happening. $6.6 billion just in Arizona, right?
Right.
Unfunded?
Right, and I'm confident we've, let me pause here and explain. We've done this probably 10 or 15 different times to different organizations, other councils, other organizations, this exact presentation. So I'm very comfortable telling you that by the end, you'll have a good sense of why the system's in the financial condition that it's in, and you'll have a good sense of where we where the task force thinks those levers that we really need to be focused on to really effectuate some kind of legislation.
Do you have confidence or hope that those levers aren't rusted shut or in those positions, and you think that they're going to move?
I think some of the things that we've already recommended to certain employers are actually already improving their
financials. And you talk about employers, you're talking about the city of Bisbee.
Right. I'm talking about the 256 employers that are in a lot of financial hardship situations, such as the town of Bisbee or city of Bisbee.
Okay.
So we talked about the presentations from the national organizations and people who have been involved with this throughout the country. As part of that, we also had collaboration with the stakeholders, whether that's other employers, the board, the actual PSPRS board and their administrative staff, and then the labor associations here in the state of Arizona, which are the firefighters, the Fraternal Order of Police, and then the Arizona Police Association. They have participated in our discussions. I want to clarify, they're not on the task force themselves, but they were invited to all of our meetings, attended pretty much all of those meetings, and engaged in a dialogue with us. So it was very important for us to have that collaborative process as we went through this education and information stage to understand their perspective of the system. And council member, this kind of gets to your point. We as the task force walked away from that phase with six major observations. The first one really talked about the reasons for the deteriorating financial condition under the current system. And there's really four of them. The Great Recession is obvious to most folks that we went through in terms of the significant loss of income and actually asset value that occurred beginning in 2007. But that in and of itself did not cause this problem. If you look back at most of the cities, you can see, as is the case here in Bisbee, that over the last 10 years, the financial condition of this plan was gradually deteriorating. And the Great Recession expedited that, but it in and of itself is not the whole problem. You have a question?
No, there's there's a dollar amount that could be forensically mined for 2006 of what, or 2006 and a half of what kind of a condition, you know, if it's 6.6 billion now, just for the sake of a number, 4 billion in 2006. I mean, there is a number, and that number, and it's been, it's more than just 10 years.
Yeah, I was just using that as a,
okay,
if you look
okay
back over, it was predominantly obvious, and most of the,
to whom?
Most of the, well, looking back, if you look in your annual, the annual reports that all the 256 plans get, has a 10-year historical information, and if you look at those 10 years, whether you're looking this year back 10 years or 2 years ago back 10 years from that point, my point was for a 10-year running period of time, there was a pretty consistent deterioration of most of the plan's financial condition.
And you say it was apparent that trend or that deterioration in funding was apparent, and that was my to whom.
Yeah, and I would think to at one level it was the legislature. That's why you saw some reform initiatives back in 2011, and I believe there was some reform that went forward in the 2006-2007 era as well. So we've had a couple of legislative fixes at this over in the last 10 years, and that's really what I was alluding to.
Okay, thank you.
Has been addressed. The second issue is the plan design of the benefit system. And really specifically what we're talking about there, that's the annual pension increase that the retirees get. The way that works mechanically is any of the earnings over 9% in any one year, half of that amount goes into a pot that is then distributed as a annual increase for retirees. So, for example, if the annual income for the plan is 15%, the difference between 15 and 6 is 9. Half of that, 3%, would go into a pot, and then that money is allocated amongst all the existing retirees for that particular year, turned into a flat dollar amount. For July 1st, 2014, that was $165 a month. So every retiree across the state, July 1st, 2014, got a pension increase of $165. But that's mechanically how that system works. That puts a lot of financial pressure on the financial status of the plans.
And those retirees were getting those increases while actual employed and working cops and firefighters weren't getting, and in a lot of cases, weren't getting any kind of increase. But the retired people were getting bumps.
Right. To your point, council member, the calculation of the retiree increase is exactly as I explained it.
It has nothing to
do with what's going on in any part of the world, to your point. So if a city is, if their funding status is decreasing, if they're cutting off,
who's wasn't? Right.
All of that stuff doesn't factor into the calculation. And you'll see that's one of the recommendations of the task force as we move forward, is you have to look at the total status of the fund, not just 1 year and investment performance.
Okay, thank you.
The third thing really has to do with actuaries' assumptions and how real they were to what was going on in the world in any particular year. And this relates back to the second point. In the actual actuary calculations, they have not, until this year, really included that annual retiree increase as part of their rate calculation. And so it seems like it should have been in there the entire time. It has not been. It was the legal case that forced that to go in. But that's part of why the actuary assumptions are much different than what we actually saw in terms of the actual plan performance. Then the fourth one is over the period of time since the plan has been initiated, there have been benefit increases, and the most obvious and the one that most people are familiar with is the DROP program. So when the plan was adopted, DROP did not exist, and along the way, DROP actually was a benefit enhancement that was added to the plan.
Would you explain that?
Well,
how it was a benefit, enhancement, and why somebody would want to do that.
Yeah,
why they wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah, from the perspective of DROP, which is really an acronym for the Deferred Retirement Option Program, that allows a member of the retirement system to notify the employer that they have up to 5 years to really effectuate a retirement from their workforce. And the intent of that, from the employer perspective, was that would give the employer some succession planning and some time to plan to hire a new officer and backfill that position. It takes some amount of time, as you well know, to run an officer through an academy and bring them up to speed in terms of the protocol of a particular organization. So that's on the employer side. And then on the employee side, that was, from their perspective, that was an added element, an added benefit to the system that didn't exist when it started. So they effectively retire the day that they provide their drop notice, but they actually don't leave service from the organization up to 5 years later. There is a financial cost for that program, and the point of this bullet is that cost was never factored in or calculated into the contribution rate when that program was implemented, similar to what we saw with the PBI. So at a high level, those are the four reasons for the deteriorating financial condition of the plan. Another observation, which is consistent with some of the dialogue that we've already had, is there's really four major players in running this particular system. The state legislature, they're the ones who actually set and established the level of benefits for the plan. Then there's PSPRS. That's the organization that's responsible for administering the plan. And it's really important as we have this conversation to understand that PSPRS does not set the benefits. They do not set the PBI calculation. They merely administer the plan as it's set up by the legislature. And sometimes that who's responsible for what gets a little it's not as clear as it should be. And I always take a minute and pause there to make sure that we understand. The legislature defines the benefit, and PSPRS really administers those benefits. And then you have, because of the way that the structure's set up with the 256 different local plans, this body, councils, or other legislative bodies, if it's a fire district, they have a responsibility for the pension plan. They have to allocate money in the budget. They're responsible for monitoring the financial condition. And then the fourth key player, and this is the local board. That's the board that makes decisions about retirements, disability claims, disability retirements, drop programs, all those kinds of things. Those are decisions that are made by the local board. So as we observe this system, and the slide says success is a combined responsibility, in order for us to fix this program moving forward, it's going to take all four people or all four bodies that are identified on this graph moving forward, because it is a system where four different parties have responsibility for its administration and its success. The third observation, this is one where, as we've engaged and really started this process, employers need to really understand they're managing, or in many cases really not managing, a pension plan. And it's completely different from the ASRS system, which is where all government employees that aren't public safety have their pension program. So unlike ASRS, where every other city and municipality is pooled into this big pension plan, there's tens of thousands of people in that particular plan. PSPRS, again, is at the employer level, where you could literally have 15 or 20 people in a plan for a particular entity. So the economies of scale are just not there under the PSPRS system as they are in the ARS system. And as I alluded to earlier, there's a much stronger fiduciary responsibility in the PSPRS at the legislative level, the local board.
The local board being us?
That's a great question. The legislative body to me would be the town council, the Bisbee Town Council. The local board is your local PSPRS board. That's a board of consisting of 5 members, 3 of which are appointed by the mayor, and 2 of which are appointed by employees of the PSPRS system. That's a completely separate board. That's the board that's responsible for disabilities and the hiring and the drop processes, for example. So there's a clear distinction between the council and the local board. The fourth observation is really something that you all have started this process on, not only in past council meetings, but just your attendance yesterday as a city manager referenced, is really starting to know your numbers. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of your numbers here in a few slides. But your contribution amount is really made up of 2 particular components. One's the normal cost, and one's the unfunded liability. And I'll detail that in a few more slides. But really, one of the things that we're trying to get employers to focus on, so we can talk sort of apples to apples, is really focus on the dollar impact of the plan to your budget, not necessarily the rate. So a 20% rate in Phoenix might be $500 million. The $500 million number really puts things in perspective for people. And a 50% rate in one community, maybe $1 million, but that $1 million really helps to put things in the context of its particular budget. So a lot of talk starts with the rate, but what we're really trying to encourage people to do is talk about the dollar amount, and I've got a couple of examples relative to Bisbee where we'll talk about your numbers. And then the other thing that I alluded to several times, and this is where the relationship and the role of the local board really becomes important. They're the board that's responsible for approving or denying disability retirements within the system. And there's some entities out there that have a very sophisticated local board process for making that determination. And there's other entities that don't have a sophisticated process. And part of what the task force is observing is those cities that have a more comprehensive system seem to do a little bit better job in terms of managing the disability retirements and the financial impacts that those have on their particular systems.
Would you define sophisticated as you used it in that sentence?
A couple of examples. The local boards, where we see the more sophistication, is they have written policies and practices about how the local board and the type of paperwork they ask for as they're processing a disability requirement or a disability retirement. So, for example, cities like Phoenix and Mesa, they ask for a complete, comprehensive medical record of that individual almost as far back as that individual can provide, not just since they've been working in that particular entity, but almost since they've been employed as a police officer. That helps establish the medical condition that is being proposed for the retirement. So that's one way. The other way is to have outside independent legal counsel that works and is support and works directly for the board. Again, the board is a separate legal body from the town council. And so most of the plans, the bigger plans out there, again, the Phoenix, the Mesas, the Scottsdales, they have outside legal counsel that advises their board on how to process disability claims and those sorts of things. So again, having that legal subject matter expert are two examples of when I use the term sophistication, what we observe from those particular entities.
Thank you.
And I think that raises a really good point to some of this whole conversation is there are cities out there that really have, they've went through this, they have best practices, and it's beneficial for all of us who are smaller cities to understand the big cities, Phoenix, Tempe, Mesas, again, Glendale's, what they're doing, and for lack of a better word, start with their practices, their forms, their policies, just as a jumping off point as we try to implement those at our local organizations.
When you say, would you help, please talk to me like I'm a third grader, best practices. When you say best practices.
Best practices refers to those things where we know the employer is doing what their fiduciary responsibility is under state statute. So when, again, I'm going to use the local board as an example. Mm-hmm. State statute doesn't define the process that a local board should go through to determine a medical disability retirement. It doesn't say you have to do X, Y, and Z. A best practice would be, taking Phoenix, for example, where they have written that down, and they say, this is what we need to receive from the applicant, this is the amount of time we'll take to make a decision, those kinds of things. That's a tangible best practice that can be shared with everybody and try to accomplish that state statute requirement that the local board has.
Thank you.
So here's some of BSBY's numbers, and I have had a chance to talk to Sharon since then, so I'll share some other numbers that aren't written in terms of BSBY's perspective. But at June 30th of 2014, which is the most recent financial information that's available for all the plans, again, you have two plans, police and fire, and you can see there they're shown there side by side. What we're looking at here is really BSBY's unfunded liability. So that's the difference between the assets that you have in your account and the obligations that you're responsible for paying for those people who literally have already been retired, so that you're retirees. So in the case of police, the actuaries have determined that you should have right now today $9.5 million in your police account. You have $1.7 million, so your unfunded liability is $7.8 million. So the unfunded liability is looked at really in two terms. One's an absolute dollar, which is $7.8 million, and then the other is in terms of a funded status, which is the ratio of your assets divided by your liabilities, which in this case for police is 18%.
And you're talking about the city's assets.
I'm talking about the assets that are in the city's PSPRS
okay.
plan account, not your general fund.
Okay.
This is just what you have with PSPRS. So from a numeric standpoint, at the organization level, a slide like this helps you to start framing the order of magnitude that is to your organization. Whether that's, let's say, look at that in terms of what your fund balance is or what your savings account is in your general fund, and if that's $2 or $3 million, for example, and then you're looking at an unfunded liability being 2 and 3 times that. It just is one way to start framing it at a local level, the financial impact that this situation is having on your organization.
We're talking not just simply financially. I mean, you know, this affects people on all kinds of different levels.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's the BSBYs for year two plans, your unfunded liability, both in terms of a dollar amount as well as a funded status. And the funded status is what I've referred to earlier as being a number that's steadily declined for most entities, and I did take a look at BSBYs. Probably for the last 12 or 14 years, it's been on a steady decline. And you want your funded status to ideally be at 100% or greater. That's what the goal should be. That means you have enough assets today to pay for the future benefits you expect for the people who are currently retired. The other set of numbers that we put together for you all is to just look at what your contribution rates will be for July 1st of 2015 as you get ready to start, like any other entity, get ready to start your budget process. And again, there's two things. The most important thing off this slide is really the difference between your normal cost and your amortization of your unfunded liabilities. So your normal cost is, that's the amount that on an annual basis the actuaries are saying that you need to set aside for your organization if there was no unfunded liability. And so if you look at a normal cost as 11% number, that actually is pretty reasonable. And people could say, well, I could afford that. ASRS, the rate is like 11.8%, just to give you some perspective. What causes the financial condition and the pressure of PSPRS on the local entities is the amortization of the unfunded liabilities. So think of that as the net-net of everything else in reality as it compares to what the actuaries thought it was going to be. So if in 1 year the actuaries thought the plan was going to earn 7.85% interest and the plan lost 10%, that mass amount of difference, that manifests itself in your unfunded liability into the future. So okay. It's the difference between reality and the assumptions.
Can I ask a question?
You can.
The fund had some bad years, and I'm probably being kind to saying that. What would you estimate the percentage level circa 2007 through 2011? How much did that fund lose in its investments? What would you say? Just a ballpark figure.
I'm comfortable telling you, I think it was somewhere around 25 or 30%. Just as an order of magnitude. Again, it wasn't all, but in those years, it was a measurable amount.
Is its sustainability right now circa, or I should say, is it around 59%? Is that where that fund sustainability is at right now?
Are you talking about the funded status?
Yeah.
The funded ratio of all the plans in the aggregate, I think, is at 49 or 50%. If you put them all together.
Doesn't sound so good, does it?
No. And so that's one of the reasons we're looking at what we're doing, obviously, but we're also, that 50%, there's an old saying, nobody's average. And so when they say, well, what's the funded status of the entire plan, you say 50%, and then you look at yours, and you're 18 and 8, for example. So that's why it was real important for us to really say, don't, as an employer who's responsible for having enough money in these plans, the average doesn't really tell you where you are. Read your reports, understand what's going on, and know what you are. The average gives you some perspective, whether you're better or worse off, in a relative perspective, but the absolute is really what you are.
Well, let me, so I clearly understand this once again. The fund lost a huge amount of its value, and so that is the reason the city portion, using this city as an example, is going through the roof. And so it seems to me that the regular Arizona retirement system during those bad recessionary years, they did okay, it appears. Why did this, the PSPRS, why did that fund essentially collapse, it appears?
I think there's two answers to your question. One is when you compare PSPRS to ASRS, at a high level, what they were invested in was not the same because their investment return objectives were different.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why they're going to be different.
I know.
And then within that, to kind of answer the question about PSPRS, and this is over about an 8 or 10 year span of their investments and what they've invested in, they've evolved to have a much more sophisticated investment portfolio today than they did 5 or 7 or 8 years ago.
Would that mean
so several years ago they were more highly invested in real estate, for example. Okay. Today less.
Yeah, I understand that. This year, the regular Arizona retirement system had a return of about 19%, but maybe a little more.
Right, it was 18 or 19, and PSPRS was about 14.
19.2, and the PSPRS, I think, was 13.8, ballpark figure. Yeah. Why that disparity? Why that difference in that? So I don't understand that.
Well, again,
I know it's more conservative. Would you say the PSPRS is now more of a conservative investment?
The way that they're structured right now, and again, I'm not involved in them making the investments, but my perception is exactly what you just said.
Okay.
They're more conservative, which is consistent with getting a lower return in the markets that we've had over the last 18 months or two.
Okay. Let me understand one other thing. Now, there's a board that oversees the fund manager. Is that correct? Is that how that works? There's a board, I assume, appointed by the governor's office that oversees the manager of the fund and his people. Is that correct, how that works?
Yes. I talked earlier about the four players.
Yes.
PSPRS. They have a seven-member board. All of those members are appointed by the governor for their terms. And then within their board, they have administrative staff and contractual relationships that do all the investing. So they have some personnel, say four or five, I'm not sure the exact number, and then they also have probably 8 or 10 investment contracts, and they have each contract for each different type of investment. So if they've got equity investments or stocks, they're going to have a firm that does that, et cetera, et cetera. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. It appears that PSPRS went conservative perhaps at the wrong moment in time, and the regular ARS had a pretty good return this last year. So I don't know what the board, how much scrutiny they pay over, plays over the fund manager. Is it a lot? I mean, I don't know how that works.
What I can help you with there is that the PSPRS board defines how the assets are allocated into the different types of investments. So what percent goes to stocks, what percent goes to this or that. The board sets that on an annual basis. And so to your point, they've changed that allocation over the last 3 or 5 years to be at the position that they're in now.
One other quick question in the same regard to this. We had that little form up in Oro Valley yesterday, and it said 31% public equities. So I was thinking, which ones? And so should not the county municipal governments receive a detailed accounting of what all those investments are, maybe every 3 months, quarterly? I don't think we've ever received that type of information exactly where those investments are. What's your thoughts on that?
That was the thought I was just going to share with you.
Okay.
One of the recommendations we're making is that the employers on that issue and a lot of other issues have got to get more engaged with the PSPRS board. And I don't want this to sound wrong, but it's really the employers and the employees' plans, and it's being administered by PSPRS, and that's not always clear to people. Sometimes, as I alluded to earlier, a lot of people perceive PSPRS as being the decision makers about the level of benefits, and they really are the administration. And I share a perspective of that. It's a lot like how the council interacts with your constituents. If they weren't happy about something, they would be here on a night like tonight. And I have observed that as employers, we have very rarely ever attended a PSPRS board meeting, either as a collective group or as an entity who has one particular issue. And we think the task force is starting to serve as that repository, and we're starting to build a relationship with PSPRS, not only the board but the administration, to do exactly that. I mean, we should be having discussions as employers about how they're investing money, what the assumptions they are, all those kinds of things. We should share our thoughts on that as part of the board making their decision. That's how government works, quite honestly.
I know there's always lots of checks and balances in government, so we have a board that oversees the manager of the fund and his people. Who oversees the board? Is that the state legislature, or is that the attorney general's office? Is that the governor's office? Who oversees the board? I don't know that.
I can't answer that question for you. I know that they're appointed by the government or the governor.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what kind of reporting structure and how that works. So thank you for those questions. The next observation is the point that I just alluded to, Mayor, in answering your question, which is it's all about improved employer engagement on just about every level. And I'm pleased with the work of the task force. We've attended most of the PSPRS meetings since we've been formed. We're out here getting feedback from councils and other organizations like we are tonight, and we feel comfortable about our ability to share that with PSPRS on any level of concern from any one of our employer members.
Mm-hmm.
And that will continue to do nothing but grow and have more of an impact. And on a personal level, I'm very encouraged by that. The sixth observation, this is one that a lot of people probably don't like to hear, but again, from the perspective of the task force, we don't think that any plan changes that are being imposed upon either existing members or existing retirees are possible, because we think they're going to perpetually be legally challenged. You've seen that with the changes that were proposed back in 2011, which is the Fields case. That was the case that really proposed changes to their annual annual increase that I talked about earlier. That's been recently overturned. The financial impact of that are now reflected in your July 1st, 2015 rates. And there's another case coming right behind that called the Hall case, and that really applies to changes to current employees. So back in 2011, the employees were contributing, I think, about 7.65% of the employee contribution, and that legislation increased that contribution up over 3 or 4 years to the point of being 11.65%. So that increase now is in litigation, and if that were to be upheld, again, the employers would be the responsible people for making up that gap within their plan, because that money would essentially be refunded back to the employees. So if they contributed 10% in 1 year, and they should have contributed 7.65%. So again, that's an observation of the league or of the task force. It's not a legal opinion. But it really makes things hard as we're trying to move forward to have all this stuff tied up in litigation. And when you see in a few slides about some of our recommendations, we're going to be recommending as one of our criteria things that aren't legally challengeable. In other words, we don't think that's responsible reform to have all this stuff settled in the court of law. So that's phase one. I appreciate all your questions. We spent literally 4 or 5 months going through that, again, learning all that information and condensing that down to six observations. But I think it builds off the next part of the presentation and gives you a sense of where we are as you start seeing what we're thinking about doing in terms of reform recommendations. And that's really what phase two gets at, is that there's some things here that, let's flip the slide. There are some things here that we've identified that if we share with employers, we believe they can improve their financial condition today without waiting for either the resolution of the legal cases that I just talked about or more broader legislative pension reform. So as we entered into this phase, we want employers to really ask themselves two questions. What's the financial condition of my plan? And again, I would say you all as a collective body are out ahead of that curve. You've had some of those discussions. We'll have some more of those here in a few minutes. And the second part is, how can I improve the financial condition of my plan now? In other words, how can I increase my liabilities at the same time I'm reducing or decreasing my liability, or increasing my assets and decreasing my liabilities? So we've come up with seven employer recommended practices. The mayor's alluded to several times, as well as the city manager. We had a meeting yesterday at a regional level down here in this part of the state and talked about these employer recommendations at great length. So your staff really knows all the ins and outs of what these means, and I don't intend to go through every one of these. I'm going to highlight one or two, and then I'll take you through the example of the number three, which is about deferring the Fields case. One of the things that you see here in recommendations five and seven and six is really understanding your long-term projections relative to this. I was sharing with Sharon earlier that when you deal with financial issues, sometimes if a financial issue is a one-time issue, we have to spend $2 million to fix this, and then once it's fixed, it's done. That is a completely different or easier discussion than a conversation where things are moving $500,000 or $600,000 every year for literally the next 22 years. This latter part, that's what we're dealing with pensions. And so the more we can look at the impact over a long term of what it's what the impact is to the employer organization, you'll see a slide here in a minute of that, the better we believe as a task force the policy discussions can be in the near term in terms of how to resolve it. It's fair to say we didn't get here overnight, and we're not going to get out of this overnight. And as part of our recommendations, we acknowledge that fact that there's a responsible part to that, and the sooner we can start implementing some of these, the sooner we'll realize the effects of those. So the one recommendation that I thought would be most appropriate to talk about tonight is really the Fields case that we talked about earlier. So when the board, again, Mayor, this is kind of back to your point earlier about employer engagement with the PSPRS board. Back in the spring, the PSPRS board decided that the employers could defer the financial impacts of the Fields case up to 3 years. And when you received your rates for July 1st, 2015, there's a rate where if you defer it, and then there's a rate if you do not defer it. And your decision is due to PSPRS by March 1st of 2015. So what they're asking is that each employer tell them, or tell the board, what you intend to do, whether you intend to defer it or whether you intend not to defer it. And so one of the items the task force created was really a tool to help your finance director understand the cost of that deferral if you were to invoke that or whether you were to not, in terms of what would be deferred. So in the end, like anything, if you defer the cost, it's going to cost you more money in the long run, but it will be shorter in the near term. So in other words, in layman's terms, the next 2 years, if you were to defer the impact of the Fields case, your contribution would be lower the next 2 years, but then the next 22 years, it's going to be higher because of the compounding impacts of deferring and getting the money into your account sooner. So specifically, we took a look at the Fields case relative to your the fire and the police department. So what we're saying here is over the 22 years, and that's the period at which all of your costs are amortized and projected over in the plan, if you were to defer paying the money to the PSPRS board, in other words, pay the lower amount the next 2 years, over the subsequent 22 years, that would cost you an extra $275,000 over the course of all of those years. Not per year, but in the aggregate. At the end of the 20th year, you would have paid $275,000 more. This is that decision reflected graphically. So the green line is if you were not to defer it, and you can kind of see how it stays pretty consistent, just a level increase. The purple line is the deferral. So you don't pay as much the first 2 years. So you'd pay $402 next year, and then $489 the next year. And then the third year, you'd pay the $597, and then $621, and $646. So you can see in year three and all the way out, the purple is higher than the green. The aggregate of that is the $275 that I alluded to earlier. So from a policy perspective, what you'll have to answer is whether you want to pay the lower rate for 2 years or not. And then you'll have to notify the PSPRS board of your selection. Mayor, looks like you have
a question. Let me ask a question, because sometimes I get a little confused. It appears to me that this is somewhat speculative in the sense that if the Dow Jones goes to 40,000, we're home free probably, right? But if it collapses, we have a bigger problem. Let's say it collapses in half. What's your thoughts on that? You're the expert, I'm not.
I'm going to answer that. Go back to the two components of your rate. You have a normal cost, and you have unfunded liability. What you just referenced, that'll affect your normal cost. It's not going to affect your unfunded liability. The Fields case, there was a definitive financial impact that was caused by those 3 or 4 years where those retirees did not get an increase. PSPRS went back and really paid everybody retroactively. And so for the City of Bisbee Police Department, that was a number. I don't know what the number is. Say it was $300,000. You need to put that money back into your account. And that's really what this deferral is about. So it doesn't affect, it does not affect your normal cost. It really addresses just your unfunded liability and how quickly you pay that money back into your account. So from a, I wanted to call this out because this is, from a timing perspective, this will be one of the first formal decisions that you have to make relative to PSPRs. And again, that's due to them by March 1st of 2015. I have the same graph for the fire department. The numbers are different, but the concept and the content in terms of what the numbers would be are exactly the same. Lower the next 2 years, more the next 20 after that. Are there any questions on that? That's the, try not to throw a lot of mathematical slides up there, but those were the two that really wanted to hone in on this. So from a perspective of making a case not to defer, and we understand that that needs to be made in the context of total resources in your whole budget, it's really not about fields to the task force. This is a correction. In other words, this amount of money should have been in our rates all along. And so for that reason, we feel the sooner you put that money into the account, the fairer it is, especially to future residents and taxpayers. Also remember, as I alluded to earlier, Hall might be coming right behind it. So you might have another sort of one-time hit to your account. And so if you defer it, let's say you choose to defer it for the 2 years and Hall gets decided, then you might have Hall hit in the second year of your deferral and then have a Hall impact on top of that. So it kind of might snowball and compound. Honestly, we think in today's investment market, it might be better to take some bad news, the deferral, with some good news of some investment income. So if you put that money in, you're going to earn more money on that money, which will help your overall account. Mayor, that was to your point. And then the governor, the fifth point I want to make, the governor and his budget in terms of how he directed state agencies to deal with this, because, again, Department of Public Safety, Game and Fish, they're all part of PSPRS, so they've got to answer the same deferral question. And he commented that it was his intention that the state would not defer the impacts of this. In other words, take that hit in their next year's budget, give PSPRS the money they're due so that you don't see that uptick in that third year and then on out. So just, it's a policy decision at the local level. Here's some reasons that you would not defer the Fields case from the perspective of the task force. So hopefully there we've talked a little bit about some of the tangible things that employers can do. And again, your staff has more detailed information on the ones that I didn't specifically call out tonight. Some of those are more applicable to other organizations, but every organization should have a discussion about all seven of those to see how much they do apply. The third one really gets to, third phase, really gets to really the reform issue. And the way that the task force has looked at this is we're going to build a yardstick upon which any reform proposal can be measured against. And so the yardstick's going to have a goal. That goal is going to be supported by principles, and then those principles will be supported by plan design elements, which is, for example, what the contribution rate of the employee and the employer should be. So in developing that, and again, this is what we're in the process of doing right now, really we're answering two questions. What should the employee, the retiree, the employer, and the taxpayer get out of the system? And then the second is, how do we accomplish that? So that gets into plan type, cost sharing, annual pension increase. These seem like really easy questions. The answers to them obviously are very hard. The first question, the employer might answer differently than the employee, for example. But as the task force is putting together our recommendations, this is really what we're trying to answer. And I don't know that the current system has real clear answers to these two questions. That's part of the reason it's in the condition that it's in. So guiding principles that are leading us through this discussion really are three. Whatever the system, it needs to be adequate for the employee as an employee and then when they retire. So it needs to provide an adequate pension for the retirees. And then it needs to be affordable, not only to the employer, but also to the employer It needs to be financially solvent. The plan, from the employer's perspective, needs to be financially solvent. And then the third, Mayor, back to your point earlier, it needs to be transparent and accountable, not only to the employer, but also to the members, whether they're active members or whether they're retirees.
I have a question. Once again, these are things that I don't know. A guy by the name of Mr. Cross, who was a fund manager at one time for this particular fund, I'm certain that he's not with the PSPRS anymore. I'm going to put you on the spot, but I don't want to, so I'm trying to come up with another answer. Was the fund mismanaged? I guess that's what I'm asking.
The task force, I don't have an opinion on that. The task force didn't talk about that. I think the point you made earlier a little bit about performance in certain economic cycles is that record is what it is. I think it's most important to look at what they're doing now with the money relative to what they're trying to accomplish. And I'm comfortable telling you at the current time, I think you've seen a vast improvement of having a clear goal and investing to that clear goal. These are our three guiding principles as we try to answer those questions and develop this yardstick. So really there's 15 elements, if you want to call it that, of a plan design system. Again, I don't want to go through all of these. I want to highlight a couple. Some of them I've referenced earlier, and I just want to elaborate on that. The 12th one is one we've talked about before. Is really, it needs to be legal. So if we look at where we've been, if we try to impose legislative changes on current employees or retirees, those changes have wound up being litigated. So from our perspective, as a task force, we'd prefer not to repeat that. In other words, if we're going to change, let's make sure whatever the reform is, that it's legal, however that's defined. Another thing that we've talked a lot about is number four, which is the cost and the risk sharing. So again, in the current situation, the employee contribution rate is fixed, and the employer pays whatever that difference is. In other systems like ASRS, for example, that cost is split 50-50. So if it goes up 1% a year, the employer contribution rate goes up 0.5%, the employee goes up 0.5%. We haven't developed what we think that rate should be, but we feel fairly strongly that if costs are going up, the proportionality of that cost sharing needs to be maintained in perpetuity, which is different than what we have now. And then I think one of the other things that we talked a little bit about, Mayor, too, is about being consistent and clear with the investment strategies. So what are they, and what are they intended to accomplish? For example, a lot of people focus on the rate. The rate of return now, for all the assumptions that this system is built on, is 7.85%. And on the surface, that's one thing you think about. But the other thing is you need to think about what's your willingness to be on either side of that rate. So in one year, you're willing to be at 20%, and down 10% one year. So it's not just the rate, it's how close to that rate do you want to be. That closeness or that disparity also drives how investments should be allocated. And we think the employers should share their perspective on that in terms of how much risk we think the pool should be taking with the money that's in the plan. So it's not just about the rate, but it's about the risk and that span of highs and lows that we're willing to accept. Because in simple terms, if they earn less, means the employer has to pay more, real simple terms. If they earn more, the employer would pay less.
I appreciate your comments about transparency. I wondered if you could tell me something about a group called Desert Troon. Are you familiar with that somewhat controversy? Is that a bad thing or a good thing? What's going on there?
Mayor, I'm not completely familiar with the background on that. I'm vaguely familiar. I'm not comfortable providing an answer in terms of how they or didn't do what they were supposed to do.
Excuse me. Mayor, why don't you tell us? You've piqued my interest.
Well, I'm going to take the, since I'm sitting in the mayor's seat and my legal advisor's over here, I'm not going to form an opinion at this point in time because I don't think there's been a legal opinion formed from any legal agency, i.e. the Attorney General's office, but look it up on the computer. I think you'll be interested to see what's going on there.
So that's you're not going to even You want me to look at Google it?
It's a property management company, and there are some concerns and questions about it. I'm going to leave it at that.
Well, why did you even bring it up and ask him to give his opinion on it?
Why did I bring it up? Because I was curious of what he might say about it. Same thing you're grilling me right now.
I'm not grilling you. You're the one who brought it up. I'm just trying to get some more. You piqued my interest, and I'd like to know what you know about Troon.
Councilmember Connors, I've said all I'm going to say on that. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Speak.
I'm not going to say any more about it.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Sorry about that. That's no apologies are needed.
Thank you.
This is the devil's in the details slide. Okay. So we got goals and principles and then elements. And so providing recommendations and answers to all these elements, that's where the task force is at right now. And that's really why interactions like this from employer members to members of the task force is really, really critical. So we can make sure when we hear about governance and we hear about investments that we're adding value to these recommendations. So even the exchange that just happened, as ironic as that might be, added some value to why I'm here as we move forward. So the yardstick, when we're done, the task force will make that, share that document with the executive committee of the league, and that's the committee that formed us. And then that, it's the expectation that that can be a tool to evaluate any reform proposals, regardless of where they might come from. And I think that's a unique approach that's been taken. I think in other places and other parts of the country, what you've seen is a proposal come forward, and then you have to evaluate. And so what do you evaluate it against? And so this is a little bit of a spin on that, is let's have the tool to evaluate them against before we get them. And I think it'll make for a much more constructive evaluation of whatever the proposal will be. And we look forward to the responsibility of being able to put that together. So to kind of summarize, we spent a lot of time with education and collaboration, and we're proud of that. We didn't exclude anybody through the process to date. We're out here engaging the employers, as I've referenced several times. We've got some tangible practices for the employers to start thinking about at a minimum and hopefully doing some of those. We talked about the yardstick, and then as I've referenced several times, the legislative solution, whatever that is going to take some time. And so from the task force perspective, it's important for us that we do what we can while all this other bigger things are going on, but at the end of the day, it'll make that transition to whatever a new system is that much easier, mm-hmm. because some of those elements and characteristics, we will have already explained the value of having those. So with that, you have my contact information. Again, Barbara Fleming from the city of Sierra Vista has been here observing and listening. You have Barbara's perspective of this. She and I probably heard some different things. Both of those will go back to the task force. But I do want to acknowledge this council and the staff as being, if there's 256 plans out there and you have two of them, you're probably in the top 20 plans that have had this kind of engagement on the issue. I appreciate the exchange and the dialogue that you've had. And if there's any final comments or final questions or suggestions that you have of the task force, again, that's part of the reason that we're here tonight.
You probably mentioned it, but it escapes me. How long has the task force been in existence, like a year? Or
it was July of 2014.
Okay.
So
very good.
What is that, 8 months?
Well, you're making big progress.
we're feeling really good about the progress we're making.
Incidentally, Barbara Fleming is sitting in the back.
Yeah, Barbara Raven.
Yeah. And she's from Sierra Vista.
I would like to make a comment, if I could. One of the things, Mayor and Council, that we didn't point out is that Scott's former position is a finance director for Paradise Valley, and their rates last year were almost as high as ours, if not higher. So he had presented this at a GFOA conference that I was at, and he's walking in the same shoes. And these are some of the things that his council has done. So it's a finance director from a city that is dealing with the same types of problems that we have.
And
Mr. McCarty and Ms. Fleming, thank you very much for coming over. Do you have some more comments, Mr. McCarty?
No, I was just going to grab my stuff.
We very much appreciate that, and I would hope that the task force has a certain amount of transparency that they show to the county and municipal governments in the future, especially the investments and the investment trends that they might want to use. In other words, more conservative or more risk-taking. I think that would be good for these particular government entities to see that. And we should see that.
I get one more bite at the apple. And I didn't reference it. All the presentations that we've seen and all the documents we've produced are available on the league's website. I should have mentioned that early on. So you can see what we've seen. You can see what we're drafting. Presentations such as this are out there. So it's real important for us to be transparent, obviously, as we go through this process. Again, thank you for the opportunity to come down here and visit with you this evening.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Mayor, quickly, I can't say thank you enough to Scott and Barbara for the level of participation that they've had. They've been a great resource for us even before now.
Yeah.
I think what was presented as we enter budget season, we will have to make some very tough decisions. I think the magnitude of what we have to consider going forward, quite frankly, was laid out for us. And also, the other piece, I've talked to Sharon about it, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to have her be a part of the task force, even as an ad hoc member, just to get more information. Given our circumstances, it certainly helps to have someone on our team to have a seat at the table. And so we have had those discussions, and we'll be contacting Scott to get his blessing, if that's okay.
Perfect. Thank you. Sure. Yeah. Any other comments from the council?
I just want to thank the Arizona League of Cities and Towns for putting together that task force, because it seems like a really great thing to have that. So thank you.
We will move on to item number 6, discussion and possible approval of entering into a streetlight pole use license agreement between the Arizona Public Service APS company and the City of Bisbee for the use of streetlight poles in various areas throughout the City of Bisbee, Arizona. Mr. Climack, Public Works Director.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor and City Council. Good evening. Before you is a request to approve a streetlight pole use license agreement. This is the one that I had excluded from the last meeting. I had it on the agenda previously. The numbers, we were using last year's numbers instead of the numbers for the year 2015. There was a cost associated with each assembly attachment. So this year, the assembly attachment cost for maintenance and under the license agreement is $7.36, for a total of $2,104.96, which is the cost of the license for mast arms on APS poles and also to be able to access their pole and use it.
Any questions from the council? Do we have a motion?
I move that we approve entering into a streetlight pole use license agreement between Arizona Public Service APS Company and the City of Bisbee for the use of streetlight poles in various areas throughout the City of Bisbee, Arizona.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to approve entering into a streetlight pole use license agreement between Arizona Public Service APS Company and the City of Bisbee for the use of streetlight poles in various areas throughout the City of Bisbee, Arizona. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Mr. Climack.
Thank you.
Next, we will move on to the City Manager's Report.
Sure. Very quickly, Mayor, a couple of weeks ago when Council Member Sullivan came on board, she's kind of been the flag bearer for citizen engagement, and she and I had a couple of conversations of how do we engage citizens and start creating champions within our community. And one of the things that I've had the opportunity of participating in my former community is something we'll call it Bisbee 101, and it's an opportunity to truly engage our citizens, invite them into our house, you know, open up the veil so folks can see how we actually operate. Cindy has participated in that process and trying to get us up to speed, application process and things like that. As well as Sergeant Chava, he too has been involved in that process. So we'll be looking to try to roll it out sometime maybe April time frame and over the course of a five-week period give folks an opportunity to come in and spend time in our various departments and get to ask questions. And it's not a town hall format. It's not really what we're looking for. It's more of an kind of an academic context. You know, just come, learn, listen, and ask questions. And so you'll be hearing more about that in the coming weeks. The other thing, Mark Appel, chair of the Planning and Zoning Commission, has asked that even here tonight, announced on February 19th, at their meeting to talk about the general plan update. Certainly want folks to come out, give their input, feedback, thoughts, ideas, and et cetera. So, and that's all I have right now.
Thank you very much. We have a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second. We have a motion and a second to adjourn. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. This meeting is adjourned.